Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday morning. Coming up in just a moment, Salman Rushdie will be with us. He has written the story of his life, and it is an extraordinary story. The book is Joseph Anton, a memoir, and there is special emphasis on the 10 years, which started in 1989. I was reminded of all the demonstrations that were taking place really all over the world. He had written a highly acclaimed novel, The Satanic Verses, and Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini said that he wanted to inform the proud Muslim people of the world that the author of the book he called Satanic Verses is against Islam, the Prophet, the Quran, and all those involved in its publication who are aware of its content are sentenced to death. Salman went into hiding for more than a decade, and a good chunk of the book is about those 10 years. And the stories of his allies, his opponents, trying to keep his son from going crazy about all of this, trying to keep himself from going crazy. He also is quite a scholar, so it looks a great deal at his education in England and his life in the United States. So that will be coming up shortly, and I want you to stay tuned. It's an important book, and absolutely absorbing. I'm Kathleen Dunn with Gina Dragutinovich, who is with us in our studios here in Milwaukee. And as you know, you are listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. We rely on listener contributions to pay for all of the programs that you enjoy here on the Ideas Network. This is our fall membership drive, and we're asking you to take action by becoming a contributor to WPR. Every gift helps support the programs that you rely on. Please make yours at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
That's right. Last hour we heard from 53 donors, and 26 of those were new, so we thank you so much for that. And right now, we have a dollar-for-dollar match up to $1,000. And this generous match is offered by a fellow member. It's their way of encouraging you to join your fellow listeners in supporting Wisconsin Public Radio. But there aren't many of these matching periods left, so please get your pledge doubled right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And also this hour, when you pledge $180, we'll say thank you with a copy of Joseph Anton by Salman Rushdie.
The book it's a book that everybody's reading. Nancy Pearl said last week when she was with us that she's reading this. I've spent a good chunk of the last week reading this book as well, so it's something that I know you would like to do. WPR is a unique radio service. It's a service well worth your support. You rely on this show, and you also rely on this station every day. Keep it going by making a pledge of support at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And remember, right now we have two extra reasons to give. There is a dollar-for-dollar match going on where your pledge of $50 becomes $100 or $100 becomes $200, and that's thanks to an anonymous member. And as an added incentive, we have something very special for you. You can get a copy of Joseph Anton by Salman Rushdie when you give $180 right now. This thank you gift will not be available later in the drive, so ask for it now when you make your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
In just a moment, we'll be talking to Salman Rushdie about his book, and discussions like these are possible because of your financial support.
Listener contributions do make up nearly 40% of our budget. The number of listeners who contribute to WPR is growing, and that's key to our strength. So we're asking you to jump on that bandwagon today. And if just 1% or 2% more of the listening audience joins as donors, it makes a huge difference to WPR. Please be one of those people who makes a difference right now. Give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And just a reminder that if you can contribute $180 or more, we'll say thank you with Joseph Anton by Salman Rushdie. How do people contribute, Gina?
By contacting us online at WPR.org, or they can call us at 888-202-2552.
Thank you very much. Salman Rushdie is with us now on the Ideas Network. His book is Joseph Anton, a memoir, which is the story, really, of his whole life. But I find myself caught in the time when he was on the run for a good 10 years. He had to go into hiding for more than a decade after that fatwa was issued. He had allies who were generous. He also had opponents in places where you would have thought there would have been allies. He also had a young son who he had to keep in touch with to make sure that he was not going to go crazy as a result of what was happening with his father. It's a very, very absorbing book, and we're delighted to have him with us to talk about a number of issues here on the Ideas Network. Salman Rushdie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
Yeah, nice to have you here. I've been so absorbed in your book for the last week, and I'm still back, you know, in the whole time when you were in hiding, and
yes.
I know things are better for you now, but oh my gosh, what a time. What a time. I'd like to start with your son and also with your father. There's a moment in the book when you're on the run, you're in this Welsh cottage, and you can't get a hold of your son, and you had promised, and you did faithfully talk to him every night at 7 o'clock, and nobody answered the phone, and you were just beside yourself.
Yes, it was. I mean, it really was, I think, the one moment when I almost totally fell apart, because I really felt something might have happened to him. Especially, not only was nobody answering the phone at his house with his mother, but we got a police car to drive by the house, and they reported back this sort of terrifying line. They said, all the lights are on and the front door is open.
Mm.
And I think, you know, you can imagine what one begins to think. If that's the case and nobody's answering the phone, I began to see kind of terrifying scenarios of what might be inside the house. And I mean, it turned out all right, because it turned out that he had just been held up at school with his mother, and they had forgotten to leave me a message, and the police car that had driven down the street had looked at the wrong house. So they'd looked at another house with the front door open and the lights on, and so it turned out just to be a dumb mistake, but the effect of that mistake was to give me a couple of the worst hours of my life, I think.
Yeah, you probably just collapsed on the floor.
Yes.
And we know that feeling for parents, and we can't find our children.
Exactly.
But you had more reason to feel that than most. How did you keep him? Tell me more about those phone calls. How did you keep him, it was probably for you as well,
yeah,
from absolutely falling apart, considering what was happening? He was a young person.
Yes, he was only 9 when this began, and 21 when it finished. So he more or less had to grow up through this nightmare. And what I found very early on was that I had to treat him as being older than his years, really. And I found that if he was hearing the news from me first, of course, I was trying to put the most positive spin on it possible. So I would say, yes, there are these horrible things happening, but it's going to work out all right because there are these police looking after us and, you know, it's going to get fixed. But as long as he was hearing it from me first, he seemed able to handle it. I mean, if there were days when somehow I couldn't talk to him, and then somebody in the school playground said, have you heard what's happening to your dad, then he would freak out. So I found that the best way of helping him through this was to, in a way, bring him inside the nightmare and just talk to him about it, and just say, here's what's going on. And I must say, the fact that he had to deal with all this, and on top of that, when he was 20, his mother passed away, so he had to deal with that awful event too, and that he's come out of it so strong. I mean, such a kind of, he's a very gentle, extremely good-natured, well-balanced young man of 33 now, and I think it's a great tribute to his strength that he came through this.
And now let's talk about your father. You describe yourself as being your father's son, godless but fascinated by gods and prophets, and also a product, at least in part of the deep-rooted Muslim culture of South Asia. If it weren't for your father and who he was, you really wouldn't be who you are.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that I think people who've read any of my novels we'll see that there are often difficult relationships between fathers and sons in them. I mean, there's actually one in the Satanic Verses and another in Midnight's Children. And it's no secret that my father and I had quite a difficult relationship for much of his life. It got fixed by the end, I'm happy to say. But what was nice in this book was to make, if you like, a much more sympathetic portrait of my father, to talk about the way he thought, his cast of mind, the things he was interested in, and how much of that he handed on to me, and just to be able to say that in all kinds of ways, I really am, you know, my father's son, even down to the point that we had exactly the same voice. You know, when I would answer the phone, his friends, or either way around, he would answer the phone, my friends would start talking to him as if he was me, and vice versa. We both had to stop people before they said anything embarrassing.
Did you like that?
Well, I mean, it was, you know, it was kind of a special thing to feel that you and your father have the same voice. But as I say, it could sometimes get embarrassing.
The other you also talk a lot, which is fascinating part of the book as well, your time in England studying, and this just by chance, really. Isn't it amazing how one person can make such a difference in our lives? You're at Cambridge, and for the first time, this subject is offered on Muhammad, the rise of Islam and the early caliphate, and you're the only student.
I'm the only student, and I was really lucky in that I found a brilliant professor who taught me. And yes, I was a course of one, and it was actually during that year of studying that I came across the so-called incident of the Satanic Verses, which is a sort of incident about the supposed temptation of the prophet and his overcoming of the temptation. I mean, that's what essentially it falls into, that line of stories of temptations of prophets, which the Bible is full of. And I remember when I was studying it thinking, that's a good story. And, you know, as I say in the book, 20 years later, I found out how good a story it was.
Yeah, it sure was. When you think back about it now, are you still happy with the fact that you took that class?
Yeah, I am. I mean, it was really helpful to me. And it was one of those moments when, you know, we all have teachers, if we're lucky, who make a big difference in our lives. And this particular professor, whose name was Arthur Hibbert, was one of those. And I remember he taught me something. He just said something one day, which I never forgot, about writing history. He said, you should never write history until you can hear the people speak. Mm-hmm. He said, because if you can't hear them speak, you don't know enough about them and you're not ready to tell their story.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking that's good advice about history, but it's also great advice about writing fiction. And I took it very much to heart, and I always have tried, as a when creating characters, to answer that question: how do the people speak? Are they talkative? Are they taciturn? Do they use bad language? What is their accent? Exactly how do they speak? And once you work that out, you know an enormous amount about them.
Hmm.
And that's one of these few lines of our education that stick in our head that really shape the rest of our life, and that's what he gave me.
You describe yourself when you were, and this must have been hard to go far away to an English boarding school,
Yes. When
you were still a fairly young person, the three bad mistakes you could make, but you could only make, if you made two out of the three, you could be forgiven, but Salman Rushdie, you were foreign, you were clever, and you were bad at games.
That's right. That's the triple whammy. Because if you're foreign and clever, but you're really good at sports, then you're
right.
Forgiven. You know? And if you're clever and bad at sports, but you're not foreign, then that's okay, too. So you can get away with two of the three, but you can't get away with all three.
But you were a reader. You were a reader from early on.
Yes. I think I became a writer because I love to read books. And I think that's not unusual, actually. I think talking to friends of mine who are writers, very often the love of writing comes out of the love of reading.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, a big bookworm, you know. I mean, I can remember, and my teachers knew it. They would sort of recommend books to me all the time. I mean, I remember my old history teacher at high school, at rugby school, at boarding school, was the person who recommended to me The Lord of the Rings, for instance, you know, when I was, I guess, not even 15. He said, I think you'll like this. And I went away and fell into it and was in love with it for a year or more. I think it's the right age to read The Lord of the Rings to be a 15-year-old boy.
You described this moment. Let's move to the moment where you learned that things were going to be very difficult for you in life and all that you did during that over 10 years when you had to be in hiding.
Yeah.
There's a time when you describe listening to the radio. You're driving home in London and there's news about you and you realize that the news is all bad. I put that moment in my mind because you were on the radio listening to the news and it was about you.
Yes, it was... If I remember correctly, that day was the day that they staged this burning of the Satanic Verses in the town of Bradford in the north of England, which is a town with a large Islamic population. I came home after listening to all this news on the radio, and then saw these images on TV of the burning book, and I was just revolted. You know, it seemed like such a disgusting image. To anybody to anybody really, especially because the book was, they had nailed it to a post and then set it on fire. So it looked as if it had been first crucified and then burned. And just the you know, the meaning, the symbolism of that image was so horrifying. It reminded me, of course, the great line of the German writer Heinrich Heine, who said, where they burn books, they will afterwards burn people.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, which is a line which reverberates to anybody who's ever studied the Holocaust, you know, because that, yes, that began with book burnings, too.
Yes.
And I thought, here we are again, you know. And it was not just an upsetting moment, it was kind of a disgusting moment.
Yeah, I would imagine. And shortly thereafter, was it, the Ayatollah Khomeini issued this fatwa?
Yes, it was 1 month, exactly 1 month later. I mean, in that month, the temperature just, you know, went sky high. And, you know, tempers got raised very high. And in the end, yes, Khomeini jumped in to raise the stakes even higher. And it stopped just being an argument about a book. It became an argument about international terrorism, which is what the Iranians were sending in my direction. And not just me, by the way, but because everybody who was implicated in the publication of the book was threatened with death as well. And there were many attacks on people. I mean, this was a shooting war. You know, there were bookstores in America and Britain and, you know, across the world that were firebombed. There were many threats leveled against people in bookstores and in publishing companies. You know, anonymous voices would call up and say, we know where you live and we know where your children go to school. And there were actual attacks. My Norwegian publisher was shot three times in the
yes.
back.
Oh.
My Italian translator was knifed and beaten, and those two mercifully survived and recovered. But my Japanese translator, Professor Hitoshi Igarashi was his name, was murdered at his university in Japan one night by an elevator when he was working late. And these were all, I mean, it was clear from police investigations that these were not just random attacks. These were professional hits. These were, you know, hired assassins. And so, I mean, this was a terrifying time, not just for me, but for many, many people.
Mm-hmm. And there were some publishers around the world who were brave and who did exactly the right thing.
Yes.
You also detail the head of a European publishing house who had bulletproof glass installed in his office.
Yes, I'm afraid. One of the things about the publishing history of the Satanic Verses is that, yes, some people behaved astonishingly well. I mean, just with great courage and principle and, you know, you could almost say nobility. And others, not so much. So, yes, there was this publisher whose office was on the second floor of the building. And so he had the second floor of the building bulletproofed, the windows. But the first floor, which is where everybody else worked, he did not have bulletproof.
Oh, my. And who were your allies? It's always good to hear those stories. You had very many friends who were very generous.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the great things about writing this book has been that I've been able to finally say, after all these years, who helped and how much they helped. You know, and I think one of the big themes of the book is friendship and the way in which people rallied round. My friends rallied round and defended me, both publicly. You know, for instance, I mean, one of the great public advocates that I had was my dear friend Christopher Hitchens, who we've lost so recently. And I mean, when you're in a fight, that's who you want on your side. And you certainly don't want him on the other side. You know? I mean, and then there were people who were fantastically helpful privately in helping me find this accommodation that I endlessly had to find, or sometimes even moving out of their own homes so that I could live in them when there was a kind of emergency need for somewhere to go. And then there was, of course, you know, emotional support. I mean, I think one of my friends, the American writer Bill Buford, who was at that point living in England and editing the literary magazine Granta, he said this thing to me which I never forgot. He said, your friends are going to form an iron ring around you and you'll be able to live inside it. And that's what they did. And remember, this is the literary world. It's the most gossipy environment on earth. These are people who usually are accused of not being able to keep secrets to save their lives. You know, but to save my life, everybody shut up, and nobody leaked a single secret for over a decade.
Isn't that something? I mean, on the other hand, there were members of the British Parliament who were a little afraid.
Yeah, I mean, it was very strange, the kind of attacks that came in, towards me. I mean, in a way, maybe you could understand that there were conservative politicians who knew that I didn't vote conservative and had been a critic of Margaret Thatcher's administration and so on. And there were a number of those who were hostile. But there were also a number of liberal, or allegedly liberal politicians, Labour Party politicians, who were also hostile because their constituencies had large numbers of Muslim voters and they wanted not to annoy them. So I sort of got it from both sides. And there was also a quite shocking, I mean, still shocks me, really, degree of hostility from sections of the news media, an attempt to say that essentially this had been my fault, that I wasn't a nice person, and that I wasn't deserving of public sympathy because I had done all this to make myself famous and rich. And, I mean, one of the things, one of the many arguments I could make is that if you were trying to write a book to make yourself rich, The Satanic Verses might not be that book.
Exactly. You know?
I mean, it's not exactly the kind of... it's not exactly 50 Shades of Grey, if you know what I mean. It's,
yes.
It's a much more complex thing. And anyway, but there was that kind of attack, and I think to an extent that worked. I think in England, a section of even public opinion became prejudiced against me, and some of that persists even to this day. And I always found the moment I left England, that disappeared. Hmm. Whether I went to, you know, Europe or to America, I suddenly found that I was getting much more understanding and a much more sympathetic hearing, and people kind of got it. Automatically and instantly, that it was, you know, that whatever you thought, it was absolutely unacceptable to try and kill somebody because of a book they wrote.
Right.
And I think there's no question that the enormous support I got in America, both from politicians and, you know, writers and intellectuals and members of the public, you know, that huge support and feeling of understanding is one of the reasons why, when things got better, you know, I made my life in America. I've moved to New York and I've been living there now for the last dozen years.
Hmm. You know, it still knocks me out to hear you say to kill somebody because of a book that he wrote. You just throw your hands up and you say, what?
Just,
how do you respond to that? What?
I know. Well, it's one of the things. There's a line I have somewhere in the book which says, one of the awful things about this whole business is that the unimaginable became imaginable. You know, you would have thought that it was unimaginable that somebody would be killed just for writing a book.
Right.
But that's what people tried to do.
Yeah. You had to find all of your hideaway spots?
Yeah, that's right.
Wow.
I mean, and this was very, and I think, you know, in retrospect, looking back at this, I mean, I don't know whether I made a mistake. The police told me I shouldn't go back to my own house because it would be too dangerous. But also that it would, you know, endanger the neighbors and it would be essentially very expensive to protect the street. Or to protect me and the neighbors. And I agreed, therefore, to enter this strange underground world because they also said, we're not going to find you the houses, you have to find them. And you can imagine the pressure and stress that created, because at the same time, I'm supposed to be invisible, you know. How does an invisible man rent a house?
Right.
And nobody knew this at the time, and I think there was a perception that I was being provided at great expense by the state. With what we all know from spy novels to be government safe houses. Well, if there are such things as safe houses, I was never offered one. And had to, as I say, had to find these things, often at great expense, because there were all kinds of requirements. You know, I had to house four armed policemen. And on top of that, there had to be requirements about the kind of house it was. It couldn't be a row house. It had to stand in its own ground. It had to have entrances and exits which were discreet and other people couldn't see. So on, all these requirements, all of which pushed the rental prices sky high. And then sometimes I would rent these places and they would say after a few weeks, oh, we think it's been blown, you have to leave. And all that money would go down the drain. So I once said to them, I remember, I said, supposing the Satanic Verses had been a poem, you know, supposing we were talking here about a poet rather than a book rather than a novelist whose book is, you know, has now become very popular, what would you have done if I couldn't afford all this? And they said, well, fortunately, we don't have to answer that question, do we?
Yeah. Salman Rushdie is our guest. We do have time to take some phone calls for him. If you'd like to join our conversation, I would be particularly interested in hearing from some of you who have at least started the book because it is totally absorbing. Joseph Anton, a memoir. We have to find out about the name, too. Why Joseph Anton? It's a nice story. Salman Rushdie is our guest. He is the author of 11 novels. He is a highly decorated author. I believe his film, a film on Midnight's Children, will be coming out soon. We'll ask him about that. This is really the story of his life, with a particularly long part devoted to all of the years that he had to be in hiding because a death threat had been issued. He was to be killed because of a book that he wrote, The Satanic Verses. I also want to tell you that we're in a pledge drive, and so let me just say this, that the book, if you can pledge $180, we would be very happy to say thank you and send you a copy of Joseph Anton by Salman Rushdie. And you can do all of that by going to WPR.org or 888-202-2552. But feel free to join our conversation with him if you would like. If not, that's okay. But if you would like, we'd like to hear from you. 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Salman Rushdie is our guest this hour. His book is Joseph Anton, a memoir, and we're welcoming phone calls for him, 800-486-8655, for you to join the conversation. And we'll start our calls with Faid from Fond du Lac. Good morning. Are you there, Faid?
Yeah.
Go right ahead.
I'm here.
Go right ahead, sir.
Yes, let me describe. I'm a Muslim, and I'm considered a very liberal Muslim. And I'm also involved as a professor in a number of diversity-related projects at one of the universities, which is part of the UW system.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, what was the reason to write this book? Because it inflicted so many psychological pains to so many people around the world.
Salman Rushdie.
Well, you know, first of all, I would say books don't inflict pain unless you read them. If you don't like a book, you always have the option not to read it. The reason for writing it is, I mean, if you want the answer to that question, I've just written a memoir which explains how the book came to be written, and it seems to me it was a perfectly serious literary work, which many people, maybe not you, sir, but many people feel that. If it's a book that is not to your taste, don't read it. You know, that's why there are books by different people in bookshops. You certainly don't start threatening people and trying to burn the world down. That's not an appropriate response.
You, and I'm wondering if you still would respond this way. You did an interview for, I believe it was CBS News, back in February of that year, 1889, and you said that you didn't feel that your book was especially critical of Islam, a religion whose leaders behaved in this way probably could do with a little bit more criticism.
Yeah, well, that was an interview that I gave on the day that the Khomeini fatwa was announced. I mean, it was within moments of my having heard that news. And yes, I'm rather proud of having said that. I mean, it seems to be quite right to say that a religion whose leaders threaten novelists with death could do with a little criticism, certainly. And actually, I do think that there are many, many people, including many Muslim readers of the book, who don't have the problems that that caller had. In fact, it was interesting to me that a couple of weeks ago, I was doing an event in London, and a young man stood up from the audience who said he'd been involved at the time in demonstrations against the book and had subsequently read the book. And he said, I found it to be a really beautiful book, and I thought you actually wrote it for us, and I'd like to apologize to you for how I behaved. So a number of even the people who attacked the book at the time, many of whom did so without reading it, subsequently read it and found that they actually liked it.
Let's go to Dave in Green Bay. Hi, Dave.
Hey, guys. What I'm wondering is, with all the religious people that are going crazy over these things, what makes you feel that you're safe? Or why did they stop coming after you?
Well, I mean, again, it's a long story, Dave, and it's in the book. But essentially, the main danger, not just to me, as I say, but also to publishers, translators, booksellers, the main danger, in fact, the only danger that we ever really identified was emanating directly from the Iranian state. That's to say, it was not random people. It was professional assassins in the employ of the Iranian state or their proxies. And basically, there was a long campaign which I was involved in to get those threats removed. And in the end, thanks to enormous pressure, including enormous pressure from the Clinton administration here and the Blair government in Britain and European allies, the Iranians were persuaded, you know, at that, I mean, whatever it is, a dozen years ago, to withdraw that kind of attack. And then actually intelligence services spent a long time trying to verify that they had actually called the dogs off and they were doing what they said. And that actually is now the case. So that, I mean, of course, there's no such thing in life as 1,000% guarantee of safety. But the real threat to everyone involved in the satanic verses ended when that Iranian threat ended.
Please tell us, Salman Rushdie, where you were. You write about this in the book on September 11th.
Well, you know, I mean, I was primarily living in New York City at the time, but I wasn't there on that day because I actually had a novel just come out. In fact, one of the strange coincidences of my life is that my novel Fury, which is a novel about New York, came out on September 11, 2001. That was its official publication date. So I was actually on book tour, and I was in Houston, Texas. I'd done a reading in Houston on the night of September the 10th, and I was supposed to be flying. I think I was supposed to be flying to Minneapolis actually on the morning of September the 11th. And then, of course, you know, nobody flew anywhere because of what happened. And I was actually called by a radio journalist in my room and told to switch on the television, and did so. And I did so just in time to see the second plane.
Mm. And then somebody told you, or you thought it may be a good idea for me to go to England to see people who I love and who love me to make sure that everybody's okay.
I think it was one of the most interesting and valuable pieces of advice. There was some psychologist who was interviewed on television in those days, who said, you know, if you're a New Yorker, if you're living in New York and you have family elsewhere, it's not enough to just call them and say you're fine. You have to go and show yourself to them in order to show them you're fine. And so for a while I couldn't do that because, of course, international flights didn't start flying for a while. But the moment they did, yes, I went back to England in order I could see my boys and say, look, here I am, I'm in one piece.
Yes.
And I wasn't even in New York on that day.
Yeah. I'm wondering how you live with, at one point, and this is again in 1989, after the fatwa was issued, you thought, I'm a dead man. You wondered how many days you had left to live and thought that the answer was probably a single-digit number. Most of us don't have to live with that kind of incredible fear, and I just wonder how you do that.
Well, you know, in retrospect, I'm not sure how I did it, and I think one of the ways is that the actual practical problems of life were so immense. You know, where was I going to spend the night? How could I talk to my child? How would I just do what needed to be done that day? That these extremely stressful practicalities took over and in a way obscured the underlying terror of the situation. And then later, when things settled down, but the fear was still there, I learned a trick, really, and it was a thing that many of the Americans and British who had been hostages in Lebanon said, that you had to find a way of putting the fear to one side. Otherwise, it's not that you became unaware of it, but you had to find a way of putting it to one side. Otherwise, you couldn't get on with your day. You couldn't do anything because it was paralyzing. And I used to imagine to myself that the fear was in a little black box, and I would put the little black box in the corner of the room. And then I would think, okay, now I'm going to go to work. I'm going to go to my desk and write. So it wasn't that I was unaware of it. It's that I played this kind of mind trick of putting it away in a little box and putting it to one side.
Jerry is our next caller. Hi, Jerry.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I just wanted to call and tell Mr. Rushdie how much I appreciate his book and also Satanic Verses. And I first read it when the hit was issued on him, and I was curious about what could a person say that would make somebody want to kill him. And it was more of a curiosity, but as I read the book, I discovered what a brilliant writer he was, and I saw nothing really disrespectful except the revealing of certain abusive practices by religious leaders that happens in all religions historically has happened. And I really love the new book, and I've been a fan of Mr. Rushdie's for ever since that hit was issued, and
so
because
much.
Of his literary brilliance.
Well, thank you very much. You know, one of the things I try and say in the book is that I was by no means the only writer attacked in this way in those years, and that if you looked across the the Arab and Muslim world in those years, many wonderful writers were attacked, and the accusations against them were exactly the same as those against me. These kind of medieval crimes of heresy and apostasy and blasphemy that we really hadn't heard much about since the Spanish Inquisition. You know, there were writers killed in, I mean, I can just remember in Turkey, Algeria, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Iran, in those years, and even the great Egyptian writer and Nobel laureate Najib Mahfouz was accused of blasphemy, and somebody stabbed him in the neck in a cafe one day for writing a novel that was totally innocent. It was a novel about the slums of Cairo, in which he used certain Old Testament stories allegorically and turn them into the lives of people in Cairo. This was blasphemous enough to get him stabbed in the neck. So there was something going on, there still is something going on across this world, which is very hostile to free expression.
We have yet to talk about, and we should, the name Joseph Anton.
Yeah. Well, I was told by the police, or asked by the police, to come up with a fake name. And there were two reasons for that. One was that, you know, I needed to rent properties, I needed to write checks, I needed to sign contracts, and we had to have a way of doing that, which obviously wasn't in my own name. And so my bank manager was in on the secret, but not many other people. That was one practical reason, but the other reason was that the police themselves, the protection squad, needed to train themselves to not use my name by accident when they were in the neighborhood of where I was staying. So, you know, in case they were running around the block or they were in the supermarket and they would suddenly say, oh, Salman asked us to pick up some toothpaste, and they would blow the cover, you know. So they said, we have to have a name that we train ourselves to use, and why don't you pick one? And then they said, don't choose an Indian name because it'd be too obvious. So I was asked not only to give up my name, but also the ethnicity of my name, which is a profound thing, you know. And I said to myself, well, if I can't have Indian names, then maybe I'll go into the world of literature, which is like my other country. And I, in the end, chose the name from the first names of Joseph Conrad and Anton Chekhov. Put it together, Joseph Anton, sounded like it might exist, for one thing. But that's how then they decided they'd make a diminutive out of it and call me Joe, which for some reason I loathed. Why should it be worse to be called Joe than Joseph, since neither of them's your name? But actually it somehow was much worse.
And finally, we'll let you go. You said that there's still something going on. There indeed still is something going on. Why?
Well, I mean, it just seems like one of the things that I felt with what happened to my book was that it was the beginning of what I've come to think of as the outrage industry, you know, where people manufacture outrage. You know, as was seen in my book, most of the people demonstrating against it had never read it. They were just pointed in a certain direction and told to be angry. And that manufactured outrage is something which has become a tool which has been used over and over again. And that's one of the things that's been happening in these last weeks.
Thank you so much. The book is just wonderful. I mean, it's really hard to put down, and there is so much in it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having written it, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks. Goodbye.
Salman Rushdie, our guest this part of the program. His book is Joseph Anton, a Memoir, and this will only happen, of course, during the pledge drive right now. For those of you who can pledge $180, we will be happy to send you a copy of this book, which maybe we should do a book club about later on. It's a big book. It's about 600 pages, but there is so, so much in it. Joseph Anton, a Memoir, Salman Rushdie, our guest, and our pledge information is this. You can go to WPR.org, or you can go to 888-202-2552. And thank you. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I don't know about you, but I'm glad we had that conversation. I'm Kathleen Dunn with Gina Dragutinovich, who is with us here in our studios in Milwaukee, one of our co-workers, a great one. And this is Wisconsin Public Radio's Fall Membership Drive. More than ever, you rely on Wisconsin Public Radio and the Ideas Network for intelligent discussions like the one that we just had. And more than ever, we rely on the money that you give to keep that talk on the air. Your gift today of $60, $120, $180, if you'd like to receive Salman Rushdie's book or any amount, helps fund the important discussions that you count on. So please give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
That's right, Kathleen. We have a dollar-for-dollar match up to $1,000 in effect right now, offered by a current member. So your gift of $50 turns into $100, or $100 turns into $200, and so on. So take advantage of this match to make your gift go even further in paying for the programs like this one. Get your pledge matched dollar-for-dollar right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You enjoyed the conversation with Salman Rushdie. I hope you enjoy his book. If you can pledge $180, we'll send you his memoir, Joseph Anton. He's a brilliant man, and there's just so much to think about in the book. Take a few minutes to make this hour and many hours to come possible. Choose a gift amount that works for you, and then make your pledge. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
That's right. You can choose Salman Rushdie's memoir as a thank you gift for your pledge of $180 or more. Your pledge will help bring more conversations just like this one to you every day. But this thank you gift will not be available to you after 10. So please, make your pledge now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
It is true that you probably don't get this kind of in-depth conversation interview with a novelist like Salman Rushdie anywhere else. I mean, we talked to him for a long time this hour. We are a unique radio service, a service that is well worth your support. Please take a moment to voice your opinion right now by making a pledge of support at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I'm Audie Cornish of NPR News. Listener support is essential to making the high-quality news, music, talk, and entertainment that you enjoy on WPR. Sustaining members make monthly contributions from a bank account or credit card. Being a sustainer is a great way to support the radio station you love.
Go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552 to make your pledge of support. I'm Kathleen Dunn with Gina Dragutinovich, and we are asking for your support of the WPR programs you count on. Thank you for in advance for your gift of $50, $100, $180, $500, whatever amount is right for you. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You know, the Ideas Network connects you with experts. How many times can you just pick up the phone and talk to the editor of a magazine, a politician, the author of a book, like we had today?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Ideas Network brings these experts right to you. So to help make that possible, give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We're here because you're here. It's really as simple as that. Listener support provides the single largest part of our operating budget each year, nearly 40%. So if membership declines, so does our budget.
And for any organization to survive, including Wisconsin Public Radio, new members need to step in to keep the mission alive. And today's the day for you to step up. Tell us you want to become a member by making a gift of support in whatever amount feels right to you at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You know, there aren't many radio stations, thank goodness for the ones that we do have, that have the mission to inform, inspire, and engage their listeners. But we do, and these values are at the core of Wisconsin Public Radio. WPR is a place to discuss and debate the issues. It's a place to examine the past and imagine the future.
And it's not something we do for you, it's something you do for yourself and for your community. Because listener support is what makes all of this possible. So contribute now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And when you give today, you may want to consider becoming a sustainer. You'll give a monthly amount, $10 or $15, that will automatically come out of your bank account or your credit card. These monthly installments will continue until you ask us to make a change.
And this means we can depend on you the way you depend on us, day in and day out, year in and year out. You're in control. You can change your giving at any time. It's convenient and an enduring way to give. So become a sustainer right now. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Please remember Salman Rushdie's memoir, a substantial book. He's such a substantial thinker. Joseph Anton, a memoir for those of you who can pledge at $180, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Your call is important to us, so please leave a message after the beep.
I want to try to help people recognize the importance of Wisconsin Public Radio. They provide such a good, non-biased background for us to make our decisions by. We need to recognize that the newspapers and the television programs are owned predominantly from the same people. So this is one of the few sources that we have non-biased information from both sides. Look at that and let's understand this little gold mine that we have.
Make your donation in support of the programs that you count on. WPR.org, 888-202-2552. I'm Kathleen Dunn with Gina Dragutinovich, and we are asking your gift to listener-supported Wisconsin Public Radio. We are 28 people short of where we would like to be, and it's only this hour that Salman Rushdie's book, which is highly recommended, it's a real substantial book, and I would think that it would be right up your alley. So pledge $180 and we'll be happy to send that to you. But whether your pledge is $50, $180, $1,200, anything above, below, or in between, we appreciate and count on your gift.
That's right, Kathleen. Salman Rushdie's book, his memoir, is available only this hour. So please give what you can. As you know, everything you hear on Wisconsin Public Radio is the result of thoughtful preparation. We do our homework so that you get the highest quality radio programs. So thank you for making this professionalism possible with your support. Give now, WPR.org, or 888-202-2552.
And the challenge we had earlier has been met. We do want to thank everyone who helped take advantage of those extra funds. We still need your support. This is the second to the last day in the Kathleen Dunn Show that we will ask for your support. And Salman Rushdie is not an easy person to book. He does this show because he knows that you will appreciate what he has to say. And it's such an important message, isn't it? I don't know how it could be more important than what he had to talk about. The drive is in the final few days. Now is the time to do your part. Help make this hour an even bigger success with your donation at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
That's right. Listeners provide the single largest piece of our budget, nearly 40%. Mm-hmm. The programs you enjoy every day wouldn't be possible without that piece of the budget pie. So now we're asking you to join your fellow listeners and keep WPR going with your financial support. Let us know that you appreciate the quality that you get from WPR. And let us know that this program is important to you by making your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
Pamela from West Bend says, I very much enjoyed the interview with Salman Rushdie, and I have enjoyed the other discussions that have aired recently. Thanks so much. And the discussions will continue, and we have had so many important discussions on the air here on the Ideas Network. You connect with us for information, for engaging content and entertainment, and your gift supports that connection for you and others across the state. Leadership gifts of $1,200 and more are increasingly important to our continued success. So if you'd like to make a leadership gift, thank you. Go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Your gift of any amount is greatly appreciated.
You decide the amount of your pledge. Every pledge is appreciated, and every pledge helps pay for the programs you love on WPR. So consider asking for Salman Rushdie's memoir, Joseph Anton, as your thank you gift today when you give $180 or more. And I say today, that's right now, before
right
the end
now.
Of this hour. Right. Go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
As you know, we do interview many, many authors, and Salman Rushdie is a very important author. I'm very glad that he read his book. It's a completely absorbing book. What you come away with, in addition to a substantial conversation, is you would kill somebody because he wrote a book. And that is something that will stay in my mind during the course of the rest of the day. The best way to support these discussions, these interviews with authors, this intelligent source of news and information, is by donating. WPR.org. Put your contribution to work right away and make your pledge with your credit card. It just takes a moment of your time. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And if you're wondering, how much should I give? Well, that's up to you. Your contribution of any amount will be turned into great programming. That's programs that will keep you informed and entertained all year long. Make your pledge of any amount right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And when you do, you play an essential part in funding the programs you count on every day. So make your pledge right now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And please remember, you get Salman Rushdie's memoir, Joseph Anton, for your pledge of $180 or more.
That's right. And do so, because today you'll enjoy a WPR pledge-free after 1 o'clock. That's pledge-free after 1 o'clock this afternoon. But to make those pledge-free afternoons possible, we need to all pull together this afternoon, or this morning, rather, these earlier hours. Sorry about that. So the time is now. Your gift right now, WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
15 more pledges in the next few minutes. Help us make our goal, particularly for this hour. This hour says a lot. You're smart. You know what this hour says. Help us make our goal at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Ask for Joseph Anton by Salman Rushdie with your pledge of $180 or more. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And
thank you. Thanks, Gina.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers, who produce this program and give us some absolutely wonderful guests. Case in point, the hour that you just heard. We have more coming up, so please stay with us, and thank you for your pledges.